good morning once again. I want to echo the thoughts that have been expressed both in our opening announcements and the prayer to greet those of our visitors who are with us. We have a very full auditorium, which is always a wonderful blessing and an encouragement to see. We appreciate so much the your visit today, and we encourage you, just spend a couple minutes afterwards, give us a chance to get to know you, a chance to enjoy your fellowship, maybe even take you out to lunch somewhere. Somebody else will buy for you, but I'd love to go there as well. We've got the opportunity today to talk about the book of Joshua, and as we kind of alluded to in the beginning of the first lesson, the book of Joshua is, on the whole, really positive. There's a lot of great things that accomplish. Israel is faithful to God. Israel does what they're supposed to be doing, and by and large, Israel keeps to the commandments of their God. We're actually going to start, though, in Joshua chapter 9, with one of the few times in the book where there's an outright mistake, where there's a clear and present indication that something happened that should not have happened. Although I will say that even in the midst of this, I think we see some good come out of this occasion. So to kind of sum up where we've gotten to this point, Israel has fulfilled their covenant promise to God. They have been obeying God. This generation is far different than their parents. They have crossed over the Jordan under the leadership of Joshua. They have been successful to this point in conquering two cities, Jericho, and after the sin of Achan being corrected, the city of Ai as well. And so chapter 9 introduces us to a new group of individuals, and that is the Gibeonites. And the Gibeonites serve as a warning and a reminder of something that Moses had tried to make very clear to the people, which is that you don't associate with the Canaanites. We talked about how even in the structure of the law itself, there was clear indications that Israel was to keep themselves separate from the nations of the world. We're going to talk a little bit more about this on Wednesday night. There's a spoiler. Come to class on Wednesday. We're going to talk a little bit more about why the Canaanites in particular seem to have been so heinous to God. There's multiple reasons that seem to be the case, particularly child sacrifice, sexual immorality, a lot of idolatry. But the bottom line is that the Canaanites were dangerous to Israel. Because Israel's intended purpose was to be a nation of priests to God and to be an example to all the world. Israel was going to be the beacon, the city on the hill that shined to the rest of the world and showed them the glory of God and persuaded them to follow as well. We've already seen a positive example of this with Rahab. That Rahab is an example of a Canaanite. We don't have any others recorded. Perhaps it happened, perhaps it didn't. But Rahab is an example of a Canaanite who has been convicted by Israel's success that this God, Yahweh, is the true God of heaven. He is the one to follow, and she's going to do whatever it takes to serve Yahweh. That's the golden example of Israel. That's the idea of Israel made manifest, that their success, their faith in Yahweh would encourage other nations to do the same. And if they compromise that witness by becoming like the nations around them, if they become idolatrous, if they become sexually immoral, if they become like the Canaanites, they can't be that good example to the nations around them. So Moses makes it very clear. You destroy the Canaanites. They have been judged by God. They have been found to be evil. You are to be God's tool of justice against them. And you are to destroy them unless they convert to Yahwehism. So the Gibeonites are a group of these Canaanites that they start to figure out something that apparently nobody else did, which is that we're not going to win this. The first verse of chapter 9 talks about that the kings who were beyond the Jordan, they all start to gather themselves together with one accord to fight with Joshua and Israel. They think, okay, maybe the problem is that each individual city is getting picked off. We're going to make this big alliance, and we're going to outnumber the Israelites, and that's how we're going to beat them. The Gibeonites, on the other hand, say, I don't think we can beat the Israelites. It doesn't look like this is a good idea. So instead, the Gibeonites act craftily. They decide to kind of deceive the Israelites. And so, apparently being very good at dress-up, they decide to look like sojourners. They're going to appeal to Israel's emotions. And remember that God has told them to be sympathetic to the foreigner and the sojourner amongst them. In fact, it appears as if even at this time, Israel did have faithful Gentiles who walked with them. They would have servants that were foreigners. So these people are trying to tug on Israel's heartstrings. They put old shabby clothes on themselves. They put on shoes that are worn down to the very sole. They put broken wineskins and their food is dry and crumbly. And they come to Israel and they say, hey, we're just like you. We're sojourners. We're foreigners from this land. We would like to make a covenant with you. We would like to form an alliance with you, fellow sojourners together. Let's make sure we don't fight each other. And on the surface of that, that would actually not be a bad thing for Israel to do. They're supposed to like foreigners. They're supposed to support sojourners because they have been sojourners. But the problem that arises and the point that the narrator of Joshua makes the point of is in chapter 9 and in verse 14, after the Gibeonites have made this claim, it says in chapter 9 and verse 14 that the men of Israel took some of their provisions and did not ask for the counsel of the Lord. Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them to let them live, and the leaders of the congregation swore an oath to them. It came about at the end of 3 days after they had made a covenant with them that they heard that they were neighbors and that they were living within their land. Can you imagine a worse job in the world than the person who had to be the one to deliver that particular message to Joshua and the nation of Israel? Hey, remember the one thing God told us don't do? Turns out we did that. They live right next door to us. They're not sojourners. They're not foreigners. They're our neighbors. They're Canaanites. They are the express people that God told us to destroy. And the problem that Israel had made, or the mistake that Israel had made, is they did not seek the counsel of the Lord. They didn't ask. They didn't go to God. And remember, we've still got the Ark of the Covenant. We've still got the tabernacle. They've still got access to God. And they didn't go run this by God first. How many times have we made similar mistakes? Where we look at something, we're like, oh yeah, this looks perfect. You know, it checks all the boxes. They're foreigners. They're sojourners. They're like us. This story sounds great. And then we make a decision that on its surface looks really good, but we don't talk to God about it. We don't pause to consider the ramifications of these actions. We don't seek the approval of the Lord. We don't seek godly advice in this occasion. And so in Israel's, and perhaps giving them too much credit, but trying to be optimistic, in Israel's rush to do good, they forget to make sure it's right. They forget to make sure it's what God would request of them. And I think that's an important lesson that we can draw from this. We've got to be real cautious about what we do. We've got to maybe take some time to think about things, to consider, to ask of God, to pray about these things, to seek the advice of the elders. Is this perhaps the best decision? Now, I'm not telling you, call Dan and John and say, hey, do you think I should paint my living room white? It's not every occasion that you have to call them on stuff. But there should be, particularly with weighty things like the Israelites are doing, we should take time to consider these things. We should make sure we're making a positive effort to consult God on what we're doing. And so when Israel goes to the Lord and all the leaders of the congregation are being grumbled at, they say in verse 19, we've sworn to them by the Lord, the God of Israel, and now we cannot touch them. This we will do to them, even let them live, so that wrath will not be upon us for the oath which we swore to them. And so the Israelite leaders are like, hey, we made a vow. And that's one of the covenant promises. That's one of the terms. Don't break the oaths you've made. Don't be a liar. So the Israelites are caught between a rock and a hard place. They've messed up, but they're not going to compound it by violating the oaths that they have taken. And so these Canaanites, and to their credit, in verse 22, Joshua calls for them and spoke to them, to the Gibeonites, saying, why have you deceived us, saying we are very far from you when you are living within the land? Now therefore you are cursed, and you shall never cease being slaves, both hewers of wood and drawers of water in the house of my God. So they answered Joshua and said, because it was certainly told your servants that the Lord your God had commanded his servant Moses to give you all the land and to destroy all the inhabitants of the land before you. Therefore we feared greatly for our lives because of you and have done this thing. Now behold, we are in your hands. Do as it seems good and right in your sight to do to us. Thus he did to them and delivered them from the hands of the sons of Israel, and they did not kill them. There's almost a little bit of humor, I think, in this occasion, where Joshua's going to them and is like, hey, why didn't you let us destroy you completely? Like, why would you lie to us and try to save your own lives? I think there's a little humor in that situation. But I do think the response of the Gibeonites is amazing. And in some ways, it parallels, I think, the response of Rahab. Now, they're a little bit more deceitful, and I don't think I can condone the deceit they perform. But they've recognized the same thing that Rahab did that said, we're doomed here. We're not going to be able to defeat you. And so you know what? You do to us what's right. But this is what we thought was our only option. We thought that this was the only way we were going to be saved. So if we're to be slaves in the house of God, so be it. That's better than being destroyed by God. And I think there's a lesson to be learned in there. That there is something to be said for recognizing your place before God. And again, as I've made the point, a lot of times we want to kind of identify with Israel here. By and large, unless you're an ethnic Jew, your identity is of the Canaanites. That's the people that we descend from, is these Gentiles that are rebellious against God, these people that have fought against God, and most of them had died against God. And so I think there's a lesson here that we should be able to recognize our place as well. That the only thing we can depend on is the mercy of God. The only thing we can do is throw ourselves before God and say, you do what is right to us in your sight. And so the episode of the Gibeonites is an interesting one because they recognize the power of God and they recognize that this Yahweh is the one true God. Now Israel is going to pay a price for their mistake. They end up having to fight this alliance of kings that after they hear what the Gibeonites have done, they decide to attack Gibeon. They're like, we're going to go take them out for allying with the Israelites. And so Israel, now under oath, has to go save their new allies. But I think it's incredible that even after making a pretty big mistake, even after doing something that they should not have done, when Joshua goes to this, the Lord tells him in verse 8, the Lord said to Joshua in chapter 10 and verse 8, do not fear them, for I have given them into your hands. Not one of them shall stand before you. The Israelites, quite frankly, might have been kind of freaking out at this point. They're like, hey, we broke the covenant. We messed up. We did something we're not supposed to. We're sparing Canaanites. Is God still going to be for us? And yet it's in this battle against these kings that are threatening their allies that we see God most directly enter here. Because it says after Joshua marches to attack this army that in verse 10, the Lord confounded them before Israel and he slew them with a great slaughter at Gibeon and pursued them by the way of the ascent of Beth Horon and struck them as far as Azekah and Makkedah. As they fled from before Israel while they were at the descent of Beth Horon, the Lord threw large stones from heaven on them as far as Azekah. And they died. There were more who died from the hailstones than those whom the sons of Israel killed with the sword. Then Joshua spoke to the Lord in the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the sons of Israel. And he said in the sight of Israel, O sun, stand still at Gibeon, and O moon in the valley of Ahalon. So the sun still stood, and the moon stopped, until the nations avenged themselves of their enemies. Is it not written in the book of Jasher? And the sun stopped in the middle of the sky and did not haste to go down for about a whole day. And there was no day like it before it or after it, when the Lord listened to the voice of a man, for the Lord fought for Israel. And Joshua and all Israel with him returned to the camp. Even after Israel has messed up, God is faithful to his covenant promises. He has sworn that he is going to fight for the Israelites. And so the Israelites play their part. They go forth to battle. But God is the one who is casting stones from heaven and striking down his enemies. He is the one who stops the very flow of time itself to allow Israel to avenge themselves of their enemies, to allow God's justice to be done. And so even in the midst of Israel making a mistake, even in the midst of this generation not doing everything perfectly, God is faithful to his covenant promises. And like we've been able to say for all five books to so far, God is the hero of this story. He is the one who brings about the faithfulness of his promises. And so the story then, after having gone fairly steady, you've kind of gone through three major battles, the story then kind of speeds up to this breakneck pace, where you see all of these various cities conquered. 31 kings are defeated. Territory is falling by droves. And this takes a long period of time. This is a period of years of time fighting and defeating the enemies of Israel. And all of that's kind of condensed for us. We don't get a big military history of this, which frankly, as a military historian, is a little bit of a bummer. But God doesn't see fit to give us all this information because he's told us what was going to happen. If Israel listens, God's going to be with them. If Israel fails to uphold the covenant, they're going to face defeat. But God is going to keep his covenant promises. God is going to be the one to bring victory in this situation. And so we see that God is faithful to his promises, and we start to see after all of these accounts of great victory that in chapter 15, the land becomes divided. That as Israel is being granted rest from its foes, it's being granted this new territory, they start to portion off the land. And you might have found through reading Joshua that this section gets a little bit repetitive and a little bit tough to get through because it's a lot of cities, it's a lot of names, it's a lot of dividing up the tribes and everything, and this can get kind of boring. This can get kind of repetitive. It's something that we're not familiar with. It's a lot of these territories that we don't know these maps and everything. 2 points to draw out. One, this would have been incredibly important to the Israelites because this was the fulfillment of their promises. Every tribe gets its allotment of land. Every tribe sees the promises of God fulfilled. And God is at work protecting all of his people, granting them rest to the Israelites. This would be the fulfillment of all of those 40 years of wandering. All of that time spent bearing the punishment of the previous generation, this is what's made it worthwhile. Because now they will have rest. They will reside in cities they have not built. They will farm for olives and grapes they did not plant. All of the promises to God are coming true. But in the midst of all of this good stuff, there's these little hints that things might not be all that they appear to be. Turn over, if you would, to chapter 16. This is why it's so important to read these passages, even though they can sometimes get repetitive, they can sometimes get boring. In the midst of all of these names of cities, in chapter 16, there's a discussion of the territory of Ephraim, one of the big tribes, and it goes through all of the boundaries and the cities that they get and all of these things. But then notice in verse 10, but they did not drive out the Canaanites who lived in Gezer. So the Canaanites live in the midst of Ephraim to this day, and they became forced laborers. It goes right on past that. Then it talks about the tribe of Manasseh. And it's just a couple of places where we see mention of this. But that should raise a big old red flag to us as a reader. We're like, whoa, wait a second. Hold on. Like, I know we had the Gibeonite issue, but that was a mistake, but it was dealt with. The Lord overcame that. But hold on. These are just Canaanites. These are just normal Canaanites that have not made an oath, that have not recognized the power of God, and they're just alive and in the land and dwelling with Israel. That is a big problem. In the midst of all of the good news of Joshua, we're starting to see the seeds planted that are going to lead to the really bad news of Judges. That Israel has been very successful in their conquest, but they haven't done it all the way. They have not finished the conquest, and in some cases, they have stopped before they were finished. We don't know exactly when this book of Joshua is written. It appears that it's written sometime later in the kingdom, and this narrator, this editor, or whatever word you want to apply, that's applying these primary sources and compiling this, those Canaanites had still not been gotten rid of, which means that their religion had still not been gotten rid of, which means that their idols and their places of worship and their influence and their sexual immorality and all of these bad things were still lurking in the promised land. Is it then that much of a surprise that so much of the rest of the history of Israel goes poorly? Because God had told them what was going to happen if they let the Canaanites dwell amongst them. They were going to fall. They were going to be failures. They were going to be corrupted. They were going to fall prey to these influences. Moses and Joshua both told them what was going to happen. They didn't listen. And it doesn't pay the price in this generation. We're going to read at the end of Joshua, this generation goes pretty well, but it's their sons and their grandsons and their great-grandsons that pay the price for them not fully following what the Lord had asked of them to do. So like I said, the book of Joshua on the whole is pretty positive, but remember that these seeds are being planted that are going to show why Israel, 400 some years after this, is going to be expelled from the land. And it's because they had not fulfilled the terms of the covenant. the book continues to go on and continues to discuss all of these various territories that are given. The cities of refuge are established. The Levites are scattered throughout the land so that Israel can continue to be faithful to God. And in chapter 22, Joshua summons the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh, those who dwelt on the other side of the Jordan in the land of Gilead. And he says, you've fulfilled your terms. You have fought with us. We have rest. We have our territory. Go back to your side of the Jordan. Go enjoy your territory and the fruits of your labors. You fought hard. Enjoy the spoils that you have won. And so these tribes of Israel, these three tribes, two and a half really, tribes of Israel go to the other side. And then there's this episode that threatens to unravel everything that's been accomplished. It says in chapter 22 and verse 10 that when they came to the region of the Jordan, which is in the land of Canaan, the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh built an altar there by the Jordan, a large altar in appearance. And the sons of Israel heard it said, behold, the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh have built an altar at the frontier of the land of Canaan in the region of the Jordan on the side belonging to the sons of Israel. When the sons of Israel heard it, the whole congregation of the sons of Israel gathered themselves at Shiloh to go up against them in war. This generation recognizes the dangers that this may present. If two and a half tribes of Israel have decided to become pagans, they've built up altars to foreign gods, they've listened to what Moses said, they recognize, hey, if we worship foreign gods, we're not going to get to keep this land. And so they are prepared, if necessary, to follow Moses' law to the letter and go destroy two and a half tribes of Israel. They are ready, if need be, to go remove the evil from their midst. And just like they had removed Achan from their midst, they may have to go remove these two and a half tribes. And so Phinehas, the son of the chief priest and 12, or the leaders of Israel, go to these tribes and they're like, what are you doing? How could you make this kind of mistake? How could you fall prey to idolatry? If these people over here are too influential for you, come to our side. Come to our part of the territory. We will give you territory. You don't have to stay over here if you're facing influence. But if you have fallen prey to idols, we will have to destroy you. Because we must keep the word of the Lord. And it's interesting because this is the same group, these Reubenites and Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh. They had been the ones to go to Moses and were like, hey, we really like this territory. Can we keep it? And Moses had freaked out on them. He's like, you are rebels who are rebelling against God. And they had to be like, whoa, we're not, no, we're not. It's okay. We're still going to fight for Israel. We would just like this to be our territory. And Moses is like, oh, that's a great idea. Okay, that's fine. And it's the same thing here. Everybody comes and they're like, you're rebelling against God. And they're like, oh, whoa, hold on a second. Let's explain what's going on here. And so it says for them in chapter 22, that they speak in verse 22 and say, the mighty one, God the Lord, the mighty one, God the Lord, let me make clear who we're worshiping here, he knows and may Israel itself know. If it was in rebellion or if in an unfaithful act against the Lord, do not save us this day. If we have built us an altar to turn away from following the Lord or if to offer a burnt offering or grain offering on it or to offer sacrifices of peace offerings on it, may the Lord himself require it. But truly, we have done this out of concern for a reason, saying in time to come, your sons may say to our sons, what have you to do with the Lord, the God of Israel? For the Lord has made the Jordan a border between us and you, you sons of Reuben and sons of Gad, you have no portion in the Lord. So your sons may make our sons stop fearing the Lord. Therefore we said, let us build an altar, not for burnt offering or for sacrifice, rather it shall be a witness between us and you and between our generations after us, that we are to perform the service of the Lord before him with our burnt offerings and with our sacrifices and with our peace offerings, so that your sons will not say to our sons in time to come, you have no portion in the Lord. Therefore we said, it shall also come about if they say this to us or to our generations in time to come, then we shall say, see the copy of the altar of the Lord which our fathers made, not for burnt offerings or for sacrifices, rather it be a witness between us and you. Far be it from us that we should rebel against the Lord and turn away from following the Lord this day by building an altar for burnt offering, for grain offering, or for sacrifice beside the altar of the Lord our God, which is before his tabernacle. Reubenites and the Gadites are like, hold up. If we've made a mistake, we'll pay the penalty for that. If we've built an altar to sacrifice to pagan gods and we've built an altar in violation of God's word, You do what you need to do, but let us explain. We did this to remember where we came from. We did this to remind ourselves that even though our inheritance is not in the land of Canaan, we don't want future generations to say you have no part in the Lord. We don't want future generations to stop serving the Lord because they're not in Canaan. So we have built an altar, a duplicate of the altar on the other side of the Jordan, to remind ourselves that we too are the people of Israel, that we too must serve the Lord faithfully, and that we too must uphold the covenant promises. And just like Moses was like, oh, that's a great idea. Phinehas and the leaders like, oh, that's a great idea. Good job. Glad to see you're still being faithful. And so you think at some point the Reubenites and the Gadites are like, can you all give us the benefit of the doubt for once? Like, we promise we're being okay here. But I think there's actually an important point to make in that. The Reubenites and the Gadites had done something, and they had asked permission, and they had done it the proper way, and they were trying to honor the Lord, but they had done something kind of odd. And they were residing in a place that normally Israel was not supposed to be in. And so naturally, people are kind of skeptical of their motivations. Can I assert to you perhaps that when we place ourselves in positions that don't look holy on the surface, that we might draw questions about that? Because there's a temptation to not be holy if you are amidst unholiness. And in fact, one of the things that we're going to see in later books of the Bible is that this region of Gilead became renowned as a place of idolatry. It became renowned as a place where people were influenced too much by the surrounding peoples. Reuben and Gad, in this instance, were doing what they were supposed to be doing. But their sons and their daughters were influenced by other people. And so can I make the point here that perhaps if we are putting ourselves in a bad situation, and when people come to question us about that bad situation, even if we're doing everything right, maybe we should reconsider. Maybe we should consider placing ourselves in the midst of holiness rather than trying to be the light in the midst of evil. Just a thought in that capacity, particularly for our young people. As you go out and you decide where you're going to live and where you're going to be, you can absolutely be faithful in a difficult place. But sometimes it's just better to go be in a place with God's people. Sometimes the long-term effects are more damaging than you might think. As we get to the end of the book of Joshua, just again as we had talked in the first lesson, Joshua is serving almost as a new Moses. He's serving as the heir to Moses. And so just like Moses at the end of his life had given the speeches in Deuteronomy, kind of his closing thoughts and his closing exhortations to this new generation, so too Joshua at the end of his life calls forth all of Israel together and gives them his farewell speech. And we could spend quite a bit of time just going through this speech because there is so much that is discussed in this speech and there's so many good things to draw out of it. But just like Moses had exhorted Israel and told them to be faithful to the covenant or face exile, Joshua echoes these ideas. He says, you have to be faithful to this covenant. You have to teach your sons and your daughters how to be faithful to this covenant. He tells them, put away the foreign gods in your midst. He says, I know you. I know sometimes we're half-hearted. We've done some amazing things here. We've conquered territory of stronger nations. But I also know the temptations we face. I know we're tempted to be like the nations around them. And he says, I'm offering you the same choice that Moses did. Choose for yourself life or choose for yourself death. And so he says in verse 14, perhaps the most famous words in the book of Joshua. He says, chapter 24 and verse 14. Now therefore, fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and truth. Put away the gods which your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. If it is disagreeable in your sight to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves today whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served which were beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But as for me and for my house, we will serve the Lord. May every man who leads a family in this assembly be able to say the same. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. I can't make you do anything, Israel. I cannot force you to be faithful. All I can control is what me and my house are going to do. And I'm going to choose God. No matter what everyone else does around me, my house is going to be faithful. And the rest of Israel responds and says, we're going to do the same, Joshua. Far be it from us to forsake the Lord. And in fact, and while admittedly, we're kind of tempted to be skeptical because we heard the same promises from the previous generation. We heard the same things that the Exodus generation said, we will serve the Lord and we will never forsake Him. And then they forsook Him a whole bunch of times. But it says that this generation at the very end of this chapter, that it said in verse 29, that it came about that these things, that the Joshua, after these things, that Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died, being 110 years old. And they buried him in the territory of his inheritance in Timnath-Serah, which is in the hill country of Ephraim, on the north of Mount Gash. Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua, and all the days of the elders who survived Joshua, and had known all the deeds of the Lord which he had done for Israel. Now they buried the bones of Joseph, which the sons of Israel brought up from Egypt at Shechem, in the piece of ground which Jacob had brought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for 100 pieces of money, and they became the inheritance of Joseph's son. And Eleazar, the son of Aaron, died, and they buried him at Gibeah of Phinehas, his son, which was given him in the hill country of Ephraim. And so the book closes, and everyone's faithful. It's the passing of this old generation. The last remnants of the old ways are buried. Joshua passes away. The high priest Eleazar is done, the last connection to the old generation. And all of the elders pass away as well. And all those days, Israel is faithful. And I think it shows the power of good leadership. That good, strong, biblical leadership has a wonderful and beautiful effect on God's people. That when they have good examples to look to, when they have good advisors to lean on, people can be faithful. And people can be inspired by that to live in the appropriate way. And what we're going to see in Judges is that when that type of leadership is not present, chaos reigns. And that's why it's so important that we today look for good leadership. That we as husbands and fathers seek to provide that type of leadership for our household. It's why we as a congregation submit to godly elders like the men that we have. Is because we recognize that leadership is important. And it's why I pray for all the rest of us men that we are aspiring to become that kind of man. Perhaps we may never be qualified to become an elder, but I pray we all have the kind of character that our elders have. And I pray that we aspire to the character of men like Joshua that seek to serve the Lord in what they do. They're not perfect. Joshua made mistakes. Israel of this generation made mistakes. But with their heart, they sought the Lord. And because of their faith, God gave them incredible blessings. But the greatest blessing of all was that they had been able to serve the Lord God. And the greatest blessing, I believe, for them was yet to come. Because they were buried, and they were gathered to their people, as we've talked about that phrase. I believe that this generation of Israel, we will see many of them in the day to come. Because they were faithful to God. And so I pray that perhaps in the midst of some discouraging passages about Israel, and I assure you, we're about to read a lot more discouraging passages about Israel. This generation that comes up is not their fathers. They are not faithful to God. There's going to be some horrible things that you read in the book of Judges. But we can take heart from this generation of Israel that faith in God is possible, faith in God is rewarded through His victory, and that God will not forsake His people. And we will see, even in the book of Judges, that even when His people fail, God is still the hero of the story, and God still does not forsake His people. As we find ourselves at the conclusion of this book, I recognize that there are many parallels that we find in Joshua to the type of battles that we fight. They're not physical battles. We do not take up the sword and the shield. We do not go over to Canaan and fight against physical enemies. But we very much fight against spiritual adversaries. Jesus warned us of those who would oppose us, of the spiritual forces of darkness that seek to overcome us. And the only way that we're going to win is the same way that the Israelites did. If we trust in the power of God, if we rely upon Him to be our sword and our shield, and we recognize the power of Yahweh. So that's what I encourage us to do today. If there's nothing else we can take away from the book of Joshua, it's that God is a mighty warrior, and He has never been defeated. And so we are about to partake of the memorial feast of Jesus Christ, our King and our Conqueror, let us remember His power. Let us remember His victory that He has won for all of us. If there is anything that we can do here to help you to be prepared to partake of the Lord's Supper, let us know now while we stand. and while we sing.